Well, is the law being used against us, or is it being used to protect us? Well, the introduction of Bill C-63, the so-called Online Harms Bill, raises that question, and that's what we're going to talk about today.
A clear path forward requires looking back and learning. Good public policy requires human connection. It's a consideration of the facts, applying common sense and innovation. It's urban, it's rural, it's real life. We all have something to contribute. We all have a responsibility to get informed, because there's a little piece of Canada in all of us, isn't there? Let's learn on this path together. This is Leaders on the Frontier.
So with me here today is our guest, John Carpe. I'm very excited to have John with us. He's the president of the Canadian Centre for Justice, and a warm welcome to you, John.
Hey, glad to be with you, David.
Well, John, you and your team at the Justice Centre must be hard at work more than ever, I know, as you seek to protect the freedom of every Canadian across our country, as we see a myriad of bills being introduced that seem on face value to be good things. But we need to really look at the details, don't we, John, in terms of bills such as the so-called Online Harms Bill. What's your quick take on this bill?
Well, it's a very clever introduction. Online harms, who could be in favor of that? Nobody's in favor of online harm. Protecting children, everybody's in favor of that. And so when the government introduced this, they said this is to protect kids from bullying and to crack down on hate speech and terrorism and all manner of evil, and we're here to protect you. And so now we've got a bill that's going to really damage free speech in Canada, impose a cold, wet blanket, chilling effect. Canadians are going to self-censor to avoid the risk of a $50,000 penalty paid to the federal government, or $20,000 penalty paid to complainant, or both, if the Canadian Human Rights Commission, in its subjective view, deems your speech to be, quote, hateful. And we're going to have criminal code amendments so that people can be placed under house arrest and forced to wear an ankle bracelet.
Wow.
Without having committed a crime, but based on what they might do in future. We've got new powers to the federal cabinet to censor social media services. We've got a digital safety commission to enforce those new regulations. We've got life imprisonment for advocating genocide. And all of this is duplicates laws that we already have. Just about everything in the Online Harms Act is already criminal code offense.
You've really done a brilliant summation of really essentially everything wrong with this Bill C-63. It doesn't sound very good at all. And I think this is in complete contrast with what we hear certainly in the mainstream media. And I do want to play a clip about the introduction of this bill, because it's, to me as a layperson, it's confusing, because you hear a lot of good things about, well, even the title is called the Online Harm Protection Bill. I mean, C-63. So if we could play that clip, let's look at what they're saying.
We begin tonight with a new plan aimed at targeting what is all too often an invisible battlefield of digital danger. Under the new Online Harms Bill unveiled today, 5 years after it was first promised, platforms would have to remove non-consensual sexual content within 24 hours of a complaint being filed, or face a maximum fine of $10 million or 6% of global revenues. CTV's Michael Couture on the new measures to take on the trigger of torment impacting lives.
Her smile, her laughter, and her innocence have all been taken from her.
Jane doesn't want to share her full name, but she does want to share her story. Over a two-year span, her toddler daughter was sexually abused by a trusted adult. Countless images and videos were posted online.
She asked me one time, she goes, "But Mom, you can take them down forever, right?" And I couldn't respond as a parent. I didn't know what to say.
But with this legislation, Jane hopes her daughter's childhood innocence can be restored and those images finally taken off the internet. The Online Harms Act proposes sweeping measures for online platforms to prevent and remove seven types of content that sexually victimizes a child or re-victimizes a survivor, is used to bully a child, induces a child to harm themselves, incites violent extremism or terrorism, incites violence, foments hatred, and intimate content communicated without consent. Now, before reading the bill, the opposition conservatives had warned it would attack freedom of speech, but the minister says that's not what this is about.
We are not talking about stuff that some people call awful but lawful. There will still be humiliating comments.
Now, the legislation will not apply to private messages on platforms like Snapchat, Discord, or WhatsApp, places where non-consensual sexual images are often shared. The NDP supports the bill, but will push for amendments.
This bill is too important to be playing around with. We need to make sure that we are getting to the heart of the issue.
Jane agrees, and she says this bill gives her and her daughter hope.
I would love those images to be gone. That is the ultimate. If that could be possible, that would be the best.
This new legislation does come with some hefty fines for online platforms that don't comply. Penalties can top $10 million or 6% of the platform's global revenues, whichever is greater. Omar?
All right, Mike, thank you for this tonight.
Hey, so there you have it. There's a very different message from the one that you just overviewed, John, where the emphasis is on trying to protect those poor kids out there online. Our heart goes out for that parent that talked about those images and the abuse that they've suffered. Surely no one can be, obviously advocating ways to protect us from child pornography and revenge pornography, horrible things. So, John, why are they leading with that message? Because it seems like there's two bills. There's that bill, but there's the second one that is very different, and we'll get into that in a moment, that talks about hate speech. So how do you see this issue, John?
All seven of those things that we just saw on the clip are already criminal. It is already a criminal code offense to post revenge porn. It is already a criminal code offense to post an intimate image of somebody without their consent. It is already...
It's already in the law, you're saying.
Currently, John, it is a criminal code offense. Also, to threaten somebody is criminal. Mm-hmm. To intimidate is criminal. The willful promotion of hatred, whether it's online or offline, is already criminal. Advocating for genocide is already criminal. Advocating for violence and terrorism is already criminal. To advocate for the violent overthrow of the government, so using non-democratic means, is already a criminal code offense. It's called sedition. It's illegal. Everything that the government is trotting out is already criminal. And what this bill does, certainly it tugs at the heartstrings, right? But it's interesting that the media there, who are supposed to be the conveyors of truth, the bearers of truth, don't even mention the fact that all of these things are already illegal. And if there is an enforcement problem, I don't know, if we need more policing, more resources, then that might be a good topic for a separate discussion. This just duplicates what's already there, except it's more than just duplicate, right? And I'm sure we'll get into that more.
Okay. So we know that those components of the bill, the first part of it, if you will, are already there in law. It sounds like a duplication, what you're saying, John. So let's talk about the second part, the so-called tools designed to protect people from hate speech online. Can you tell us more about that?
So currently under the criminal code, section 319 prohibits the willful promotion of hatred and public incitement of hatred. And so that is, if it's directed against a group based on a listed ground, and that would include race, ethnicity, national origin, sex, religion, sexual orientation, gender identity, gender expression. If you willfully promote hatred against a group on the basis of one of those enumerated grounds, you're committing criminal code offense. Now, if you promote hatred against a group for other reasons, if you were to, you know, I don't know, bankers or lawyers or people that didn't get injected with the COVID vaccine, you can promote hatred against identifiable groups, but not on the basis of those prohibited grounds of race and ethnicity, gender, religion, etc. So if you post on the internet, on your website, if you willfully promote hatred against a group on the basis of their race or their religion, you can be criminally charged and convicted and potentially locked up in jail. That law is there. It's not really knowable. To what extent does it restrict freedom of speech? Probably does not have a huge impact because it's very narrow. It's very targeted. And there are defenses available to the accused, such as the defense of truth. So if you were to say that there is a particular ethnic group where they had higher rates of crime, family violence, illiteracy, drug abuse, and if you were charged with willful promotion of hatred for saying that about that ethnic group, then you could avail yourself of the defense of truth. And you could say, okay, but here's the data. But what I said is actually true. This ethnic group does have higher rates of family violence or whatever. What this bill does, though, is it gives new powers to the Canadian Human Rights Commission to prosecute non-criminal speech that is deemed to be hateful. And hate, as you and I know, is very subjective. You and I could listen to the same podcast, watch the same YouTube video, and one of us would say it's hateful, and the other one would say, no, it's not hateful. It's just strongly worded opinion. So it's very subjective, and that's where you get this chilling effect where it's going to cause people, it's going to cause Canadians to self-censor.
Okay, so just to back up here for a sec. So with the new bill that's being proposed, the second part of it, they're weighing in with the full force of law. They will put you in jail for a lifetime, a life sentence. Is that right, John?
Well, currently the criminal code prohibits advocating for genocide, genocide being the killing of an entire people group. And it's the same listed grounds of race, religion, sexual orientation, etc. So currently, if you advocate for genocide, maximum penalty you could get if you're convicted is 5 years in jail. This bill would raise that to life imprisonment. So move it up there to being the as bad as murder.
Wow.
Okay. And then you compare that to the maximum penalty for sexually assaulting a minor under the age of 16. Maximum penalty is 14 years in jail, compared to a lifetime in jail as maximum penalty for advocating for genocide. And again, that's not plotting or planning or doing anything. That's just simply for saying that a certain people group ought to be, you know, wiped off the face of the earth.
So which John, give an example. What help us understand this. You're saying that if someone is deemed to be using hate speech or advocating for genocide and whatever those terms mean, they could be put in jail for life. Is that true?
If a court, well, let's just take the current conflict in Gaza.
So yes, the answer is yes. Is that right, John?
Yes, that's the maximum penalty. Not to say that you would get the maximum penalty, but the maximum penalty is life in prison if you are convicted of advocating for genocide.
Wow.
As opposed to 5 years currently.
So, John, who will define under this bill, C-63, who defines what hatred is?
You know, the Supreme Court of Canada, roughly a decade ago, they released a decision in Saskatchewan Human Rights Tribunal versus Whatcott. And Bill Whatcott was handing out flyers in Saskatchewan, paper flyers, pamphlets, strongly denouncing gay sex and saying it was unhealthy and was also bad for your soul and, you know, could lead to an eternal damnation. He's handing out these flyers, which some people found, or maybe a lot of people found, very offensive. And this made its way up from the Human Rights Tribunal to the Saskatchewan Court of Queen's Bench, Court of Appeal, Supreme Court of Canada. And the Supreme Court spent more than 4,000 words in its decision trying to define hatred. And it's just, it's an emotion. How do you define an emotion? You know, how do you define joy? I mean, you could take a stab at it, but to really know if something is hate speech or not is pretty difficult. But it gets worse when you have the criminal code provisions and hardly anybody gets charged with willful promotion of hatred because it's very specifically worded. If you also add on a new layer of law whereby you empower the Canadian Human Rights Commission to go after people, prosecute people, but not criminals. So if you get convicted, you don't get a criminal record, but you could be out of pocket up to $70,000. And that doesn't even include the legal bills that you may have paid for. Mm-hmm. So this adds a new layer of censorship because the Canadian Human Rights Commission can receive even anonymous complaints. So you don't even know who's accusing you.
And, did you say anonymous, John?
Anonymous.
Wow.
So they can be, that's in the discretion of the commission to anonymize or not. So you could have a situation where a guy in Vancouver files a human rights complaint against a woman in Nova Scotia because she wrote something on the internet that was derogatory about a mosque in Toronto. And even if the members of that mosque in Toronto are not offended by it, this guy in Vancouver can file a complaint against a woman in Nova Scotia over what she said about the people in Toronto. And you're off to the races, and she could get prosecuted and you know, spend tens of thousands of dollars on legal bills and ultimately be out of pocket $70,000.
Wow.
And that's not criminal hate speech. That's just what the commission deems to be hateful. Okay. It's very subjective.
But in the end, it is subjective, as you say, John. And example after example shows around the world that it's, you really can't define hate speech. It really devolves into the area of opinion, right? You have a variety of people that can say all kinds of great things about other people and not so great things, silly things, even hateful things, or that seem to be things that show dislike or contempt. But is that sufficient enough to put them in jail for life? Is that the question?
Well, the Supreme Court tries to distinguish now that currently the Justice Minister tries to explain it by saying that vilification, promoting vilification and detestation is hate speech, but promoting disdain, dislike is not hate speech. And to mock and ridicule is not hate speech. To hurt somebody's feelings is not hate speech. But if you cross over this line, I have no idea where it is. Nobody will know where the line is. But if you cross over this line and get into detestation and vilification, well, now you're in trouble with the law. Well, can you explain the difference between disdain, dislike, and detestation? It's just a nightmare from a free speech standpoint. And we're better off just sticking with the current criminal code. Prohibition on willful promotion of hatred was upheld by the Supreme Court of Canada 20 years ago, quite a while back. It was upheld as a valid restriction on free expression. So that's settled law. But you take that any further and people are going to have to worry about what they say and then always looking over their shoulder. Oh, who's listening? You know, it's terrifying.
Well, it really is terrifying when you have someone who could come forward anonymously, initiate some kind of complaint among these kinds of half-cocked human rights commissions. They could bankrupt you. They could just shut you down entirely, and you don't have any room for healthy speech and engagement and differing opinion as part of a society,
especially on important issues. I mean, I know your organization. You regularly you tackle, for example, Aboriginal issues, Aboriginal policy, and there's an example. Somebody can point their finger and say, well, you know, that's criminal hate speech. Or they probably won't do that because I don't think you're likely to get charged under the criminal code. I'm familiar with some of the things that Frontier Center has written and published. But here's a perfect example. You're not likely to face criminal charges for willful promotion of hatred just because you point out the fact that there's no evidence that Aboriginal children were murdered in Kamloops. It may have happened, but there's no evidence to support that. So by making that claim, you're not likely to face a criminal code, but you could face a human rights complaint that, you know, you're promoting hatred, non-criminal, but you're promoting hatred towards Aboriginals by disagreeing with the claim that Aboriginal children were murdered. That's an example. Mm-hmm. And, the Gaza conflict, you've got a lot of strident, vociferous speech, pro-Israel, anti-Israel, pro-Hamas, anti-Hamas. There's a lot of strident comments being made, which is as it should be. What do you expect? It's a war and people are dying. People have died. Mm-hmm. So, not all of the speech is going to be perfectly reasonable and perfectly civil. And that's just par for the course. But there's an example. People are going to be filing human rights complaints left, right, and center against, pro-Israel or pro-Hamas speech or anti-Israel, anti-Hamas speech. They're going to say, oh, that's hate speech. File a complaint with the Human Rights Commission. And we're off to the races. Here comes the prosecution.
Exactly. The other term that is also a huge flag is the term genocide. Certainly, historically, there's been well-defined definitions around a history of genocide that involves, the massacre, the destruction of large-scale numbers of a whole entire mass community. But now we're into a range where genocide is being redefined. It could mean really any type of offense, including cultural genocide. So is genocide another one of these flags where it's hard to define now in today as people try to redefine these words?
Yes. Now, to my knowledge, the Online Harms Act is not proposing to redefine genocide as it's currently put in the criminal code. And I don't have it in front of me. I haven't read it recently, but it's outlined there that it's the destruction in whole or in part of an identifiable people group, words to that effect. So again, you would not face criminal charges for researching and publishing reports about Aboriginal issues, yeah. Aboriginal policy, but it's a slippery slope. And I'm aware, and I think you're aware of people that have publicly said that it should be criminal code offense to deny the cultural genocide of Aboriginals. And that's not in the Online Harms Act, right? But you can see there are people out there that rather than wanting to engage in honest debate, rather than loving truth, which you do by refuting what is false, not jailing the person saying something that you think is false, those people, they're the same as, it's the same mentality as the Online Harms Act. They want to punish speech that they don't like. And if the Online Harms Act is passed, the people that will be censored will be conservatives and libertarians and social conservatives and religious people and generally politically incorrect speech about Aboriginal issues or immigration. That's going to be the target.
Well, I think, frankly, it hits everybody. Every Canadian will be negatively impacted by this type of legislation, because what it's doing is undermining the opportunity for healthy debate, the freedom of discussion, which has been integral to the pursuit of truth and the progress of our society. If you say that, no, you can talk about this, but you can't talk about that, then you're into that dangerous zone where the king, the queen, the prime minister is pushing their agenda over the ability of people to find out what the truth is on a variety of issues. And that harms people, including the next generation, doesn't it, John?
Well, absolutely. And the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, the protection for freedom of expression includes a right to listen. And there have been court rulings on this where it's not just the right of you and I and the other 40 million Canadians to speak. It's also the right of you and I and the other 40 million Canadians to listen to all manner, all kinds of viewpoints. And this is the problem. The attack on freedom of expression, what it amounts to is giving up our own freedom to decide for ourselves what is true or false, what is right or wrong, what is good or evil, what is hateful or loving. And instead of retaining that right to decide for ourselves, we're going to hand that over to something like the Digital Safety Commission and the Human Rights Commission to decide on our behalf. And so we're not going to hear the same diversity. There's a good word, diversity. I believe in diversity of speech.
Intellectual diversity.
And intellectual diversity. Yeah. And that's going to be harmed by the Online Harms Act.
I'm very concerned, John, that Bill C-63, the way it's been presented, very much concerns me that they have essentially tabled two types of bills. One is about some kind of enhanced effort that really duplicates what's already there in law to protect children. And they're using this as cover to really introduce legislation that will destroy freedom of speech as we know it in this country. It will happen not just overnight, it will happen over time. And it will change really the fabric of our culture. So people, as they go about their day-to-day interactions, will always be second-guessing, just like they did in East Germany so many years ago under the Stasi. The secret police were endlessly monitoring each other for things that were ill thought out. It's almost like that movie with Tom Cruise, The Minority Report, for crimes, thought crimes, and for the anticipation of crimes that could happen, because that's all within the terms of this bill. Is that correct, John?
The Online Harms Act, if passed in its current form, would add a new provision to the criminal code that makes it possible for a complainant to file a complaint with the provincial court and say, my next door neighbor, I fear that my next door neighbor is going to commit a speech crime. I fear that my next door neighbor is going to willfully advocate for hatred or advocate for genocide, and go to court, and your next door neighbor will have to appear, and the judge is going to make a ruling as to whether the complainant's fear is reasonable. And if yes, the judge can then say to the accused person, okay, you haven't done anything wrong, you've done nothing illegal, but I'm going to place you under house arrest, curfew, ankle bracelet. You are to abstain from drugs and alcohol. We're going to require blood or urine samples to confirm that you're abstaining from drugs and alcohol. We're going to put restrictions on where you can go, put restrictions on who you can contact, and we're going to take away your legally owned, legally acquired firearms. Those are all conditions that the judge can place on a person who has not committed any crime, but their next door neighbor fears that they might commit a crime in the future. If the person does not comply with those conditions or declares that they're not complying with those conditions, that person can spend up to 2 years in jail. And again, without having committed a speech crime. This is in the bill.
That is terrifying.
The bill was going to add that section to the criminal code, and it's going to amend the criminal code by increasing the maximum penalty for advocating for genocide from 5 years to lifetime in jail.
Unbelievable. So, John, in this context, if we can look at the bigger picture, you know, lawfare has been around for quite some time, but it's certainly at a different level here, where you essentially use the law not to serve the people, but to use it for those in power as a weapon to place your political opponents, people who disagree with you, in jail. Is that what's going on here?
It won't always be jail, but the threat of a human rights prosecution, tens of thousands of dollars in legal bills, and ultimately up to $70,000 in fines and penalties payable, that's a huge. It will be used politically. I can guarantee it. We've seen this before when we had similar legislation, not quite as bad, but similar legislation was Section 13 of the Canadian Human Rights Act. And Ezra Levant and Mark Stein fought long and hard, and other people. They took the brunt of it, those two. They were both prosecuted, as you mentioned earlier, under the human rights legislation. So this gets political, right? So if you want to push this agenda, we're trying to fight racism, sexism, homophobia, transphobia, Islamophobia. So somebody says something that you think is racist, sexist, homophobic, transphobic, Islamophobic. Well, human rights complaints can be filed cheaply and easily. And if they're dismissed at the end of the day, it doesn't cost the complainant anything other than the, 5 minutes or 35 minutes it took to slap the complaint together.
Unbelievable. So we're entering into a new era, potentially, with these kinds of laws. And it, to me, it's very disturbing, because one of the strengths of Canada is we've had a People come from many different lands and traditions, including of faith backgrounds, people who are of Christian background, Aboriginal perspectives on larger perspectives on life. You've got people that are Muslim, all kinds of faiths. And people will, in their effort to be faithful, will advocate strong opinions about all kinds of issues. But it doesn't mean that they don't live in unity and peacefully in a tolerant way. But this potentially upsets all of that. I think of legislation like another part of legislation, like what is it called, C-367.
Oh yeah, we can talk about that.
That will effectively have a huge impact then on the public square and what you can say in terms of even citing scripture. Is that right, John?
Yeah, Bill C-367 put forward by the leader of the Bloc Québécois, it would, if passed, it removes a defense that is currently in the Criminal Code Section 319, willful promotion of hatred. Now, the defenses are outlined there. One of them is the defense of truth, which we talked about previously. Another one is fair comment and a comment on a topic of public interest. Another one is another defense that is available is the citation of religious text or expounding on a religious text or sincerely expressed opinion based on a religious text. So I'll give you a very graphic example. In the Bible, in the book of Leviticus, there is a passage there that says, and this is not a perfect quote, I'm paraphrasing, but a man shall not lie with another man as you would with a woman. And if a man engages in that conduct, he should be put to death. Now, I'm not aware of any Christians or Orthodox Jews who, you know, believe that we should be applying that literally. However, that passage or citing that passage or presenting a teaching on that passage, you could be charged with hate speech. Now, currently, if you were charged with hate speech for, you know, preaching against sexual behavior that is contrary to, you know, whether it's Islam, Orthodox Judaism, Christianity, if you were charged with hate speech, you could avail yourself of that defense. And you could say, well, I'm quoting from a religious text that says that gay sex is sinful. And so you would have a defense. And because you have that defense, you probably wouldn't get charged in the first place because Crown prosecutors are bound to prosecute only cases where there is a reasonable likelihood of conviction. So this is a defense for religious speech. Okay, so Bill C-367, if passed, would remove that defense from the criminal code. And now you'd be in a position where Orthodox rabbis and imams at mosques and Catholic priests, Protestant and evangelical ministers could be charged with hate speech if they preach against homosexuality. And they would not have the defense. And because they would not have the defense, it's more likely that they would be charged because now the Crown could look at it and say, well, we've got a reasonable likelihood of conviction.
Exactly. The other cases that come to my mind, and there's so many of them, and you're very familiar with the case of Amy Hamm because the Justice Center is providing legal support for her case. Can you tell us more about what you think are the impacts of this kind of legislation on a case like Amy Hamm?
I don't think that the Online Harms Act would have an impact specifically on a professional nurse, doctor, psychologist, lawyer, teacher, engineer. There'll be a general impact on every teacher, every psychologist, every doctor, every engineer, every lawyer by the Human Rights Commission having new powers to prosecute non-criminal hate speech. Amy Hamm was disciplined by the British Columbia College of Nurses and Midwives because she dared to say in public that, brace yourself, there are only two genders and women deserve to have safe female-only spaces such as washrooms, change rooms, locker rooms, women's prisons, rape crisis centers, female-only sporting competitions. So Amy Hamm has said publicly there are only two genders and women are entitled to have a safe space. And for this, she was prosecuted by the BC College of Nurses and Midwives. And we've just concluded the final stage of hearings have gone on. The prosecution has gone on for more than 3 years. And so the Justice Center started in September of 2020. And now we're in March of 2024. So it's been 3.5 years. And the Justice Center has been providing lawyers for Amy Hamm. So back to your question, the attacks on free speech by the professional bodies like Law Society, College of Physicians and Surgeons, Teachers College, they're not going to be directly impacted by the Online Harms Act, although they'll certainly be encouraged to censor professionals. Mm-hmm.
But John, I think ironically, that's the point. This is all part of the pattern, again and again, of laws being introduced, actions being undertaken by quote, professional associations that should know better, or all kinds of legislators who are empowering, I would call them thugs, bullies, authoritarians, who want to go around and beat people up just because they don't agree with them. Just because they have a different perspective. Now, I get it. We don't want to be hateful in this society. But part of the reality is we need desperately in this society more than ever healthy debate and discussion. That's the process by which we get to truth and that our society can move forward. And we do that with grace and tolerance. But as soon as you start introducing lifelong prison sentences, fines to boot, and a grinding down of process that will take years, then we have arrived in 1984, John.
Can't disagree with you. The other aspect we hadn't touched on yet is that the Online Harms Act gives the federal cabinet new powers to censor social media services. They can create all kinds of regulations, and those censorship regulations will be will acquire the force of law without any input from Parliament. And this is what regulations are all about. The federal cabinet, or you know, provincial regulations under a provincial law, and then we're going to establish the Digital Safety Commission. Watch out when people use that word safety. We have to remember that during the French Revolution, it was the Committee for Public Safety that chopped off the heads of thousands of people. Yeah. So be careful.
Doublespeak. It's all doublespeak, right, John?
Digital Safety Commission. Well, there's no safe space for free speech. If these people, the bill actually says they're not bound by the rules of evidence, mm-hmm. so you're going to have some very very arrogant bureaucrats. They're not constrained by the rule of law that will enforce these new censorship regulations that will be passed by the federal cabinet.
Exactly, and this is always the lesson of history, isn't it, John? That the people left. These czars, the good and the great, get appointed, and they're the ones, because they're so wise, that will determine exactly what hate is, what genocide is, what anything they say is, according to them. So this is a huge red flag. And so I have a question to you, because John, how many years have you been practicing law?
I was called to the bar in 1999. So yeah, go 20... I guess about 24 years.
So 10 years ago, would you have ever anticipated in your legal career that such a piece of legislation could be introduced at this time?
I would have anticipated that a government with a different philosophy, the Section 13 of the Canadian Human Rights Act, which you know allowed the Human Rights Commission to prosecute non-criminal hate speech, it was repealed under the Harper government. I would not have been surprised if there was a bill put forward that said, okay, we're going to bring back Section 13 back to the way it was before. That would have disappointed me, but it would not have surprised me. But here we've got preemptive punishment of people who have not committed any crime. We've got life in prison for advocating genocide. We've got anonymous complaints under the Human Rights Commission. We've got federal cabinet with new powers to censor social media services. We've got a new Digital Safety Commission. All of the other stuff, it would have surprised me 10 years ago. It's still shocking today. And you alluded to this. It's always a free speech for me, but not for thee. Because if you ask any supporter, if you were to have a supporter of the Online Harms Act, I'd be surprised if somebody comes forward to chat with you about it. But if you could find somebody, if you ask that person, well, you know, how do you feel about other people curtailing your speech if they disagree with it, find it offensive, find it hurtful? And that person would probably say, oh, no, you know, I should be allowed free speech, right? So it's free speech for me, but not for thee is the underlying philosophy behind the censorship.
Well, I think one of the things I find so inherently bad about this legislation is not only its content and its implications on the right of freedom of speech, but also what I find so offensive is the use of the front part of this bill around online harms as cover, manipulating our care and compassion for children and those poor parents where there's been children that say have been victimized, and using them as cover for political manipulation, really, of the real significant part of the bill, which is really about going after freedom of speech. So I think this is really, that says it all, doesn't it, John? That a government would use others, including the cause of children, as really cover for a pretty cynical use of lawfare.
It's a very clever marketing strategy. And this is another issue in relation to the bill, is that, you know, of course, it's right that we have criminal code prohibitions on, you know, posting an intimate image of somebody without their consent and revenge porn and so on, you know, child pornography. All of this stuff is criminal. And the big thing, though, is that the first line of defense to protect children from online harms is parents. And children are not going to be harmed online if their parents are closely, carefully monitoring not just the amount of time that kids spend looking at their smartphones or iPhones or computer screens, but also monitoring what are their kids looking at. You get a lot more online if parents are giving their kids you know, free rein to surf the internet for whatever they want, and giving their kids free rein to get into social media, then that's the first line of defense. And again, I support criminalizing the things that are already criminal. I think they should stay in the criminal code. And the criminal code should be a backup. It's really up to parents. And on this point, our Justice Minister, Arif Virani, he said, it was interesting, this was at the news conference where he's got all these parents behind him, you know, big crowd of people. And he says, you know, there are safety regulations for the Lego that my kids play with. And so therefore we also need safety regulations for the biggest toy in every home, which is the internet. And they go, wait a minute. Wow. No, it's parents that ought to be monitoring, controlling what their kids see.
Let your children just play it on the street, do you?
No. But then there's this false notion that, oh, you know, so we need the government to protect the children. Well, actually, no, we need parents to protect their own children. And you know, many parents are doing a fantastic job, and presumably some parents are not doing a good job of that. But that's a very direct and very effective way to protect children from online harm, is for parents to step up to the plate and assume their responsibilities to protect their children.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's part of the dynamic here, where we want to elevate the level of public policy and the level of, you know, the conduct around the process around public policy, so that we're not always just simply cynically using a public policy as a weapon against your political opponent. So in this case, I guess my question to you, John, would be, is there something deeper going on here? We know that through the last several years, law has been changing. We have a tradition in our Western Anglo-Saxon societies, including Canada, of emphasizing the precedent, the common law. And certainly Magna Carta was in many respects the a seminal moment in the beginning of common law, that kind of embedded in the DNA of the law A respect for precedence and how we would go together and make decisions as a society. And that had a huge bearing on our culture and our sense of freedom and working together to build a better society. And it's worked very well. But it seems like the last several years we've had a different change of the law that's been happening, one that emphasizes an authoritarianism in an effort to achieve, quote, social justice and equal outcomes. And I'm wondering if something else is happening with the law where we have a raging debate beneath the surface that this type of legislation represents the emergence, really, of Marxist law. Is that a good insight here, John?
Well, there's nothing new under the sun. There is always well, maybe not always, but certainly in the past few centuries in countries around the world, there is an ongoing war, not necessarily a war with bullets and tanks and bombs, but kind of a culture war of those who are collectivists and authoritarians, and they want a powerful government that's going to tell citizens what to think and what to do and how to behave and present the citizens with some big project, big goal, and everybody has to get on board with the project. And then there's those of us that believe in limited government and the rule of law and the individual freedoms of conscience, religion, expression, association, peaceful assembly. And so there's nothing new under the sun. When you look, we're back full circle to 100 years ago. In the 1920s in Europe, 1920s, 1930s, there were fascist movements in Europe, in just about every country in Europe. Some of them were successful. You know, they took power in Germany and Italy and Spain, Hungary, Croatia during the war, and some other countries. But even in countries where the fascists did not take power, they had fascist movements, fascist political parties. The Netherlands, which is where I was born, they had a fascist party that in one election got 8% of the vote. You know, Norwegian fascists, French fascists. Now, these were people, they didn't like the free society. And this is what we have to wrap our heads around, is that it'd be naive and foolish and wrong to assume that everybody supports our democratic rights and freedoms and a free country. Many people do not. They very much do not want to have limited government and maximum individual freedom. So we've come full circle. Now, today's fascists, they don't have the same goals. They're not talking about a Canadian master race and conquering our neighbors. And, you know, the external objective is different. Like, now we have woke fascism, where everybody has to be coerced into this national mission of stamping out racism, sexism, homophobia, Islamophobia, transphobia. And so it's woke fascism. The outside coating, it's a different color, but on the inside, it's the same fascism that we saw 100 years ago.
Wow. No, I think that's a real challenge. And,
you know, or Marxism. Marxism would be, it would be a similar example, right? The Marxists, and of course there's, you know, obvious differences between Marxism and fascism, but they have a similarity. The Marxists will say, we all have to get on board with the program and join in the great mission to create the workers' paradise and to create this equality of outcome. And the state is going to coerce everybody into producing this equal society. And so the goal is different. The goal is, you know, workers' paradise, substantive equality, but the methods are the same, and the methods mean to destroy our freedoms of expression and other freedoms.
Exactly. Yeah. This is certainly the pattern in history as people, these authoritarians work together to create their utopia here on earth. And individual rights and freedom should be put aside as they build a better utopia for all of us, supposedly. So on that note, I did want to share with you a fascinating clip that is not being seen by many people. It's actually by the Minister of Justice, who's talking about an extraordinary legal toolkit, as I understand, that the Government of Canada sponsored and is sharing with different countries internationally. And I wanted to share this clip with us.
Your Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, dear colleagues, it's a great honor to share a few words with you at the launch of the Toolkit on Mainstreaming Gender and Human Rights in the Implementation of the UN Convention Against Transnational Organized Crime. C'est un grand honneur pour moi de partager quelques mots avec vous à l'occasion du lancement de la boîte à outils sur l'intégration de la dimension de genre et des droits de l'homme dans la mise en œuvre de la Convention des Nations Unies contre la criminalité transnationale organisée. I would also like to thank the United Kingdom and the UNODC for supporting this General Assembly side event. The integration of human rights, gender inclusivity, and intersectionality in policymaking is a priority for Canada. It's also a priority for me personally. Prior to my appointment as Minister of Justice, I spent my legal career advocating for equality and the protection and promotion of human rights. This includes time spent as a UN prosecutor. Our government strives to apply Gender-Based Analysis Plus, or GBA Plus, an analytical approach that provides a rigorous method for the assessment of systemic inequalities. It's also a way to assess how diverse groups of people may experience initiatives, including those on organized crime. At Canada's Department of Justice, for example, my officials apply a GBA Plus lens to all of our work, from legal services, policy and program development, to communications and evaluation. This helps to ensure that all initiatives are responsive, inclusive, and reflective of diverse experiences and realities in order to more effectively prevent and combat crime. Their work is supported by a departmental GBA Plus unit with expertise in gender mainstreaming. We must consider the needs of all people. Canada is very pleased to fund the UNODC Toolkit through our Anti-Crime Capacity Building Program. We see its development and launch as a very important step. The Toolkit will provide resources to help support and champion gender and human rights mainstreaming efforts in the implementation of the Transnational Organized Crime Convention, and integrate recommendations and best practices shared by many countries on this issue in recent years across various United Nations fora. Our financial contribution is just one part of Canada's support to this initiative. It builds on our recognition that it is essential to integrate intersectional and gender-based analysis and to incorporate human rights considerations into all anti-crime efforts. We do this not only to adhere to relevant international treaties and customary legal norms, but also to protect marginalized and at-risk persons from harm. We want to prevent re-victimization and re-traumatization. These efforts help ensure that no one is left behind, in Canada and around the world. I commend the work undertaken by the UNODC in the development of this toolkit, and I encourage all governments and practitioners to use it as we all work to prevent and counter organized crime. Je salue le travail entrepris par le UNODC dans l'élaboration de cette boîte à outils, et j'encourage tous les gouvernements et praticiens à l'utiliser dans le cadre de leur effort de prévention et de lutte contre la criminalité organisée. Thank you. Merci beaucoup.
You can see that that clip is actually quite a fascinating window. I mean, there's certainly language that may be confusing for many people, but this is classic Marxist analysis being employed and embedded across the use of the law, from prosecution, certainly on the criminal side, to many other things. So I would encourage people to look actually at this toolkit. You can actually find it online. But I think this is a stunning example where our Minister of Justice is, I would argue, in my opinion, taking a radically different view of the law and the integration of these so-called Marxist diversity, equity, and inclusion lens in its application, John. Is that not a fair insight here?
No, I agree with you, Dave. Yeah, for the record, I'm in favor of diversity, and I'm in favor of inclusion. I'm in favor of equity.
Indeed.
But this is problematic when, if I was to, you know, sit down for coffee with Justice Minister Arif, and if we were to drill down a little bit as to what we mean by those words, we would be poles apart. So on a superficial level, I'm all in favor of equity, diversity, inclusion, all three of them. But what he means when he says gender-based analysis, you know, there are different kinds of feminism. There's a what you might call a classical feminism or traditional feminism, which says that men and women are equal and there's no reason why a woman could not become, prime minister, policeman, firefighter, doctor, lawyer, CEO of the corporation, So men and women should have equal rights. Okay, fine. That's one kind of feminism. There's a different kind of feminism that sees men as evil and women are good, and that that there's this systemic oppression, and it's against the whole notion that all of us, whether male or female, have to assume responsibility for our own choices, and that both men and women are equally capable of doing good and doing evil. So those are very different definitions of feminism. And so that gender-based analysis, I don't think it's the kind of classical feminism or traditional feminism that I myself subscribe to. And the same with the other words. He talks about human rights. Well, I fight for human rights every day. And I've got, Justice Center's got a team of lawyers and paralegals that are fighting across the country for human rights. But my understanding of human rights is that it includes our freedom to speak and to practice our faith. And I think Justice Minister Arif's idea of human rights is quite different from mine.
I agree. And I would dare say that the minister is really forfeiting his duty and responsibility to uphold the rule of law in our common law tradition. And this is where, our country needs a national debate on what kind of society, what kind of nation we want to build, a nation based on the rule of law or a nation of laws created by, I would argue, authoritarian leaders who seek to impose their political will, their way of thinking, and to deem some people with acceptable versus unacceptable thoughts.
Well, we go back, we're in the same battle as 90 years ago, 100 years ago, and a lot of it depends on what Canadians of goodwill do in terms of being active in the democratic process. Because most countries in Europe had a fascist political party or a fascist movement. In some countries, the fascists won. In other countries, the fascists did not win. And it's the same. Indeed. On that point, I want to mention we've got the Justice Center has a petition. We are currently just shy of 50,000 signatures. We're hoping to another 50,000 in the next few weeks. And these are going to be delivered to the Prime Minister's office in Ottawa in April. And I strongly urge anybody listening to the podcast or seeing the video, contact your member of parliament. And I don't care what party he or she belongs to, the MPs have to hear phone calls and emails from their constituents, and silence is consent. If you don't contact your MP, if somebody accuses you of not stopping the Online Harms Act, that accusation might hold some water.
Well said. And I really commend the center for developing that petition. I know other groups as well are trying to pursue forms of action. It's important then, isn't it, John, that Canadians as citizens speak up and be sure to contact their elected representatives, particularly if they're from other parties that are in support of this nonsense. But this is a very historic time in the life of our nation, is it, John?
Every day, every month, every year, they're all important because when we lose our rights and freedoms and we've been heading in the wrong direction for decades now, it typically does not happen overnight. It's bit by bit by bit. So we've seen previously, we've had bills C-11 and C-18 that give government more control over the internet. And those were very bad steps, but they were small. Their impact in some cases is not felt immediately. This Online Harms Act is a quantum leap. It's not just a step in the wrong direction. It's a jump. It's a leap in the wrong direction. But it's really up to us as citizens to, if people who love freedom roll up their sleeves and become more active in the democratic process, the only thing necessary for evil to triumph is for good people to do nothing, as the old saying goes. And so I think we can stop the Online Harms Act if there are enough Canadians that voice their concerns about it. Or if we don't stop it entirely, maybe we can get some of the worst provisions eliminated from it.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. So I want to thank you very much, John, for all your work and leadership on this important issue, and as well as your ongoing comments today that help us understand the importance of us speaking up as citizens for individual rights and freedoms. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me on your show, David.
Thank you for watching Leaders on the Frontier. We're a nonpartisan think tank. We explore ideas, policy, and practical solutions that can make a difference in the lives of Canadians. We do not accept any government funding. We work for you. Thank you for supporting Frontier. Visit fcpp.org to give. While you're there, be sure to check out our latest articles and research. Without open discussion and debate, you're not thinking, nor are you free. Comment below. We'd love for you to join the conversation.